It's The Wonky Show. The long-awaited international education strategy finally lands, but where's the numbers target? There's UCAS data out, latest on who's doing the hoovering, and NUS launches a new campaign aimed at mum and dad. It's all coming up.
Yes, we think this is important, but this is definitely framed as the solution to your financial worries is to not bring more international students into this country, but it is still framed as international students are made valuable, what they bring, the globalisation. And then, although I'm annoyed that soft power boils down to how many presidents and prime ministers we have.
Welcome back to The Wonky Show, your weekly way into this week's higher education news, policy and analysis. I'm your host, Jim Dickinson, and here to help us make sense of it all, as usual, three excellent guests. In Oxford, Mike Ratcliffe is senior advisor at UWE Bristol. Mike, your highlight of the week, please.
It's starting block. So we've got students back. They're doing their programme level induction, which is lovely, having students around the campus again. It's particularly lovely because it means that catering feel confident enough to reopen the salad bar.
And in Newcastle this week, Richard Brabner is visiting Professor of Civic Engagement at Newcastle and LPIP Place Fellow at the University of Birmingham. Richard, your highlight of the week, please.
Thanks, Jim. Well, I'm actually based in South East London in Bromley, but my highlight of the week was actually going up to Newcastle on Monday and Tuesday, the first time in my visiting prof role, to talk to the senior team and various colleagues up there about our Civic 2.0 campaign, which is looking at the next steps for the sort of civic university movement and how we can have more of an impact on policy and the incentives in the system. So that was all very fun and very exciting.
Lovely stuff. And near Loughborough this week, Jen Summerton is Operations Director at Wonky. Jen, your highlight of the week, please.
Thanks, Jen. My highlight of the week, work-wise, is launching the Secret Life of Students programme yesterday, because I'm really excited. We've got some great content in there. I've just got to cheekily add another one, which is that yesterday it was my birthday and my daughter made me some chocolate-covered strawberry demigorgons, which were absolutely delicious.
Amazing.
Well, that reminds me, someone gave me some chocolate at student governors yesterday. I think that's melted in my pocket. Anyway, so yes, we'll start this week with international education. This week, the government published a long-awaited refresh of its strategy. Jen, what is in it and perhaps what isn't in it?
Yeah, so I think we were told in autumn 2024 that we were due for a refresh of this. So it is long-awaited. Published on Tuesday. Unsurprisingly, though, missing our headline target numbers on international students, which turned out to be a bit of a hot potato last time. I think in 2019, we had a 600,000 international student target. So what we do have this time is a £40 billion target on education exports by 2030. And that's up 35, not up 35 billion, it's up from 35 billion in the last strategy, although perhaps worth mentioning that the methodology has changed and obviously inflation's risen quite a bit since then. I think really, you know, the focus this time is really on exports, and transnational education gets plenty of warm words. There's also a slight difference in terms of the strategy being co-owned by the Foreign, Commonwealth and Development Office and the Department for Business and Trade, along with the DfE. So there's reference to education as a soft power tool, lots about influencing, and there's a focus on student experience and support for international students as well, infrastructure, housing, that kind of thing.
Well, this is interesting. Now, Richard, on LBC this week, actually in written form, despite the fact it was on LBC's website, Jackie Smith said, if they are to survive, universities must maximise the opportunities and expand abroad. That's a signal of intent, isn't it?
Absolutely. I think whether it's the correct signal of intent will, you know, be depending on your perspective on these sort of things. I think it's sort of that this document reflects political reality, and it's essentially quite a small C conservative document in a way. I personally think its pragmatism should be welcomed, in the sense that it's telling something, it's not telling the sector something it might want to hear, but it's not also then telling something that it won't be able to deliver on. And there's clearly been some mixed reaction. I think there are some organisations that have clearly been involved in shaping this strategy have really warmly welcomed it, but I've seen various other commentary from people, particularly from the sort of international student recruitment market, that think that are sort of more negative towards it because they don't think it's ambitious enough. The sort of shift in emphasis, as you've just highlighted there, towards T&E, and obviously Jen has too, is really interesting. And it sort of reminds me of the coalition government in the sense of at that time, as you'll recall, Jim and everybody else, they obviously had, you know, international students were sort of included in this sort of net migration target of 100,000. And therefore, they didn't feel that they restricted the sort of graduate route, but didn't have a cap on numbers. And so there were sort of mixed messages there from the coalition government. But they did shift an emphasis towards TNE, thinking that it could be the answer to all our prayers. It's sort of similar in there are some synergies with that, right? But what is challenging for Jackie Smith and why the 40 billion target is actually, you could argue, quite ambitious in the sense that what it doesn't really reflect on is the sort of real internal challenges that universities are under at the moment. And are they really able to capitalise on this moving forward? And we'll know some really positive examples of TNE overseas, and they've highlighted that in the strategy, particularly in relation to India and so on. But you know how difficult it is not just to build campuses abroad, but actually deliver effective partnerships at the moment when you're restructuring your institution internally and sort of investing overseas when there's so much challenging change at home, I think is quite difficult. So perhaps it won't be institutional led, it'll be tech and other sort of innovation in the system that might lead this. But yeah, really interested in what others think of it.
Mm. Now, Mike, when I was planning the study tour this year, I was thrilled to be reminded that Premier Inn operate in Germany. Now, when we got there, without going into detail, I think it's fair to say that they're struggling to maintain quality. If there's a massive expansion in TNE, there's actually not been much regulatory attention really on TNE. Are there a set of quality risks?
Well, there are. So I think there's a lot of scope to think about TNE and its opportunities. And if you go back to a UUKI report last month, it shows how much growth we've had. But I think it also makes that point that there's a bit of a distinction between TNE actually delivered in country and TNE done by distance and other kind of flexible means. So I think there's different kinds of scopes for doing that. And obviously, there's an artifact in the report, which is that picture of them all in India with the Prime Minister thinking, well, that's a kind of big, let's build a campus kind of TNE. And I think that's the kind of big, slow burn kind of stuff. We don't know. OFS continue to threaten English providers with expanding the scope of what they're going to do and then going quieter on it again. So I think what would be really good is for some kind of backup that says, this is the kind of thing we're going to be doing over the next 3 to 4 years. So institutions know that they don't go and set up some kind of provision and then fall foul of some kind of new OFS B3 applied to people in a completely different country thing, which no one knew was coming. So I think that kind of, that report talks about taking out red tape. If we're going to start to put more red tape onto TNE, that's not going to work.
Yes, well, that's interesting, isn't it? I mean, look, Jen, one of the things I guess that strikes me is, you know, it's clearly the Foreign Office's logo is on this time, but the Home Office's logo isn't. And we still have this kind of significant split, don't we, between immigration policy and this, you know, what amounts to a kind of exports policy with some other departments. How much joined up government is going on here?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's an interesting one because in a sense, the new strategy, you know, is really seeking cross-government commitment. We've got the Foreign Office and we've got that kind of trade business involved. And that's quite a big ask. You know, I think in one way, Jackie Smith is saying, if they are to survive, universities must maximise opportunities and do this. Actually, she's also saying it has to be done meaningfully and with purpose. And, you know, doing all of this in the right way at the same time as universities facing the financial constraints that they're under is a hugely ambitious task. And, you know, inevitably will be a lot easier for some institutions than others. So we need to be careful that, you know, the sector can support all institutions to do this in the right way and with purpose. And also when it comes to, you know, the Home Office and home students, really thinking about those as well. How do we create opportunities overseas that benefit students in the UK? You know, how can we really make this across the board really beneficial and valuable for everybody and greater than the sum of its parts in some ways?
Yeah. Back on the sort of main international recruitment stuff, Richard. One of the things that, you know, I've been keeping an eye on, I've got a piece coming out on this later in the week or Monday, I can't remember now, on what other countries' international education strategies kind of say and how they frame things and so on. And, you know, a lot of other countries have kind of national level initiatives around, you know, the experience or mental health or emergency student financial support or housing and so on. And there's very little actually that moves the dial here on improving the experience other than kind of warm words on urging institutions to offer the best experience.
Yeah, I think it does mention it in this report, some things like infrastructure and housing, which I'm not sure it did previously. So I think small steps forward, you could argue in that respect. I think there are two things on that I would pick up on, Jim, that I, you know, not really, that I would like the government to think about as a next step, essentially. So firstly, it says it supports the sector-led agent quality framework, which is obviously welcome, but I personally think, and you may do too, that this doesn't necessarily go far enough in protecting students from bad practice, and there's plenty of out there, as we know about. And I continue to think that this really presents a real reputational risk to providers, and something that I hope could be looked at again in strengthening that regulatory approach to international agents, particularly in a more sort of co-regulatory approach with government and the sector together. Secondly, as you sort of mentioned about the experience, there was a sort of cursory mention of outcomes, but in a quite limited way. And in my previous role, when we ran the Student Futures Commission a few years ago, we had a sub-commission that was looking particularly at the international student experience. And for all their research with international students, the sort of graduate outcomes, employability was a real major theme, which they think this sector, our sector in the UK, needs to get better at. Not just facilitating opportunities in the UK, but as well as facilitating opportunities in the countries which they come from and they hope to go back to and forge a successful career. And obviously, you know, this is outcomes obviously about the individual student, they're about the provider and the university. But I do think there might be a role for government, not in terms of necessarily funding lots of things, but in terms of facilitating the sector and pooling resources to be able to support that knowledge, awareness and sharing, particularly over, you know, graduate opportunities overseas. The other thing from a civic lens, Jim, I think is you could always argue in any strategy that there's something missing, but I think it's sort of something that the next steps that the government could look at is essentially utilising international students intentionally to support economic and social growth in our towns and cities beyond their sort of beyond their spending power and just their place, and look at how could we facilitate their expertise, their knowledge with small businesses that particularly want to grow their sort of an export-led approach overseas in their own countries, and whether there are opportunities that can support both graduate outcomes for those international students, but also business in this country. And I think that's something that the government could look at too.
But Mike, this is part of the problem, isn't it? Because when you've got a strategy that is sort of separated from the trade-offs that the Home Office has to make on immigration policy, you end up with an international education strategy that, unlike most of the others I've read, doesn't really rehearse the stuff about, you know, whether we want international graduates, whether we need immigration to the country, the fact that we have an aging population, the role of sustainable immigration. Do you know what I mean? Like that framing of where we want graduates to end up, what the role we want students to play in the country and so on, is that framing ends up being missing in the resultant strategy and just ends up reading like, you know, here's how we'll help you sell your wares around the world.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose that framing of we support the sustainable recruitment of high quality international students, which is sat there on the face of the thing, is fine. I mean, there are clearly some paragraphs which are sat there to show the sector that they're paying attention. So that framing of genuine students, now that's a concern, because somewhere out there, the Home Office is sitting on a lot of casework, which means that it is concerned that some of the people who come here are not genuine students. And there's something weird, obviously, in the way that the Home Office, on the one hand, is activist in this area, but on the other hand, hasn't used the CAS system, where it allocates, you know, the number of students a place can recruit. You know, it's just not done anything to deal with what sometimes has looked like a bit of boom and bust in some student recruitment. So I think that kind of getting the hold of, yes, we think this is important, but this is definitely framed as the solution to your financial worries is to not bring more international students into this country. But it is still framed as international students are very valuable, what they bring, the globalization. And then, although I'm annoyed that soft power boils down to how many presidents and prime ministers we have, I think it'd be much better if we, you know, focused on, wouldn't it be marvelous to have, you know, procurement managers spread across the world with British degrees, because that would be far better for industry than the occasional president, who obviously is subject to international whim. What could we do to really say that that's where where we get value is by having a lot of people who have had the experience of British education, but also increasingly, we come back to that T&E thing, a British education that they haven't had to fly halfway around the world in order to get.
Yeah. I mean, I guess on the target thing, Jen, we should probably, on the one hand, no, there isn't an extension of the kind of big target. On the other hand, there also isn't a cap or a cut of the sort that have been, you know, played around with now in Canada and Australia and so on.
Yeah. And you know, to be honest, it doesn't take, you know, people in the sector who know how to do these calculations, you know, they can work that up into a numbers target if they want to. And individual institutions will be required to do that. You know, they have to plan for what proportion of their work will be focused on overseas, will be a T&E, might be English language, whatever, and have to diversify it, you know. And obviously, the majority of it will be international students coming to the UK. And they have to make that decision about, you know, where they want to prioritise their efforts and their finances. But I do think it's an opportunity for institutions. And again, we're hearing this from this government all the time. They're putting the onus back on institutions to be creative about how they can make more money, diversify their offer. And I think, you know, there's something in that we really need to kind of take heed of. And if we don't do it, other countries will do it. So we have to be in it to win it in some ways.
Tell you what, Richard, right? I was at Student Governance yesterday and I ended up having a conversation with four of them from a particular part of the country who were all saying that they don't think their own university could sustain a campus abroad, but the four of them could probably collaborate on a really interesting kind of multidisciplinary degree abroad. You know, are there opportunities for collaboration in the T&E space that aren't being taken, do you think?
Yeah, I'm sure there must be. If institutions are going to be creative and innovative in this space, there are others that are much more knowledgeable than me on that. But you would think that, you know, and that's where there could be a role for government in developing this strategy, whether nationally or regionally, is sort of easing out the tensions in creating sort of partnerships that could be effective abroad. And that is definitely something which they should be looking at and moving forward.
And then just finally, Mike, one of the things that does strike me when me and Mac have looked at this is that, and don't get me wrong, sometimes this is happening, but quite often it's not happening. There quite often doesn't seem to be much of an interaction between the students that are studying quite similar subjects, you know, on a T&E campus and back home. Whereas quite often academics are kind of flying backwards and forwards. And so is there more opportunity to kind of do that internationalization at home, maybe one semester at the T&E part, you know, some of that mixing that you can potentially get without causing someone to have to spend a year or 3 years in another country?
Yeah, so we've definitely seen that with the places that have got fixed scale campuses abroad. The opportunity to go and continue your course, but to do it in China or Malaysia is definitely part of the offer. And we can see, obviously, that people do it in the UK. There are American universities that bring their students here for a semester or a term and get an experience, but stay on course, but are here in a different place, but also have that opportunity to mix with different people. So I think that does play part of it. What will be interesting, of course, is whether you can do that with the technology. So if you've got your VLE set up and you're teaching the module, well, what are the opportunities to make that module available to the people who are doing it in two or three other countries at the same time as the people are doing it in the UK? What are the opportunities for group work, for sharing resources, for getting that global perspective without anyone having to move an inch? So I think there's lots more that we could develop. And I think there are some good examples at the moment of how people are making their T&E enrich the experience of UK students in all sorts of kind of ways.
Well, fascinating. Now, let's see who's been blogging for us this week.
Hi, I'm Carmen Miles, and this week on Wonky, I've been writing about why universities struggle to act on early warning data from their analytics systems. Many of us have seen this, universities investing heavily in learning analytics. The OFS sets clear continuation thresholds, yet when dashboards flag at-risk students, institutions often can't respond effectively. My article explores why this is an organisational challenge rather than a technology problem. The issue is that universities are structured for retrospective quality assurance, not proactive support. When analytics identifies a struggling student in week 3, most institutions lack clear protocols for who should act and how. Successful institutions solve this by building explicit governance frameworks and creating tiered response systems that bridge the gap between regulatory requirements and teacher judgment. You can read the full piece on Wonky.
Now, next up, UCAS has released provider-level end-of-cycle data for 2025, and it's thrown up some interesting patterns, Mike.
Yeah, so we are at the kind of time-honoured point in the cycle. We see live information during confirmation and clearing. We get a burst of information in the back end of the autumn, but that's all generalised. We get that kind of sense of things. And this is the week where we get the bit that everyone is really interested in, because this is the week where you get to look at your own institution and you get to compare it against other institutions. So one of the meta-narratives over the last couple of years, particularly that came in the summer, is that the Russell Group is out there eating other people's lunch. We've now resolved that narrative. It's that some members of the Russell Group are out there eating other people's lunch. And there's one of DK's tableaus this morning, which shows you some wonderful outliers. So we have some very big places, the top of the reputational end, that have expanded, and we can see that. And we have some other places that are therefore not doing so well. We have some interesting ups and downs. So perhaps this is the influence of the way you use the RPA process. So you record people who you've made a prior arrangement with. And so we can see some big swings. So there's a university that seems to have gone up by doubling its student numbers, and we can see another university that seems to have lost thousands of students. That's got to be movement in their franchise partners, but we don't really know. So that kind of looks exciting. We can see some providers who've shifted into new bits of business. So we can see some really kind of interesting shifts. So BPP has seemingly gone from a standing start to have a couple of thousand undergraduate students in a single year. So there's an interesting story to unpack in there. And one of the things that DK has picked up is this interesting thing about maybe there's something happening with the return of unconditional offers. And there's an interesting file to unpick in terms of having a look at that. So lots for people to kind of sit and stare at, and lots of admissions officers going, I wasn't expecting them to be bigger than us or do better than us, and all of those kind of complications. So lots of people staring at data tables this morning.
Richard, I guess in the olden days, you know, you might look at graphs over 7 or 8 years in terms of expansion or contraction, and the truth is they would generally be very gentle, right? But I have this kind of permanent sense that rapid expansion and rapid contraction is not something that the higher education sector is suited to in terms of its ability to then respond to suddenly having a hell of a lot more students or suddenly having far, far, far fewer students. Is this, you know, is this kind of rapid, you know, choppy waters in the market, it's sensible?
So as Mike mentioned, if that's largely to do with franchise partnership, you'd have thought the impact would be less than if it's obviously residential students coming in and out of a particular place for obvious reasons. Mike has highlighted obviously the impacts that are really interesting, which I'm sure recruitment officers and others will be really interested in, the dynamics of individual institutions. But I think it's probably worth looking at the bigger picture as well in this sense, and some really interesting trends that are continuing or otherwise. So first, from I suppose a civic lens, really interest the growth of commuter students, and we're coming to the next sort of item on this podcast is looking at obviously the NUS report on the cost of living, and I think that's really driving that growth in commuter students, and it has some really interesting dynamics at play which I don't think we've really got to grips with yet as a sector. Clearly, there's some, you know, really important, continues to be really important stuff around different regions and the demand within different regions, and having a civic lens, and also that trend, as we've seen, STEM becoming more popular, and it really does sort of make you think, you know, there's been lots of critics for the sector in the last few years that are sort of criticizing certain types of subjects and degrees and sort of outcomes as a result of that, but basically the market in a smaller way than they would like, or in a slower way than they would like, is responding to some of those criticisms in the sense that we are getting more STEM, engineering is becoming more popular, and things like performing arts are becoming less popular. So I think these are some really interesting dynamics there.
I mean, one of the things obviously about the figures, Jen, is we're used to these euphemisms about the kind of three categories, high tariff and low tariff, and, you know, I can't remember what the phrase, medium tariff providers. But, you know, one of the things about that kind of fairly rapid growth of high tariff providers is that it's not that high anymore.
Yeah, I mean, it's quite mixed in this, isn't it? And I think it's, you know, I'm sure there will be many of those providers that are quite pleased to see that this this is kind of balanced out a little bit now. But there are still some, you know, and I think that needs to be looked at. And, you know, I'd like to hear more about what those institutions are doing internally to kind of plan and support programs that may be, you know, offered to less capable students that might need more support. And I think that's a really big area. You know, there's a lot of silo working going on in institutions, and the admissions and marketing teams don't necessarily speak to the academic departments and the student support departments. So there's still an issue there. Although you're right, we have seen a mixed view on these results, which is quite good. I mean, I think what's really interesting about this is just that, you know, you mentioned the kind of choppy waters and whether that's a good idea, but as much as this may look erratic, there are reasons for this. And, you know, Richard's kind of sort of mentioned a few of those things. We've got, you know, economic issues and people opting for courses that they think actually perhaps going to serve them, you know, in the future a bit better. Whether or not you think that's the case, you know, is another whole podcast. And, you know, we've also got the regional, you know, the kind of commuter student community as well, which again, we may come on to later. But there are clear reasons for these trends. It's not a kind of erratic for the sake of being erratic. I think, you know, this is institutions seeing their customers responding to the kind of economic environment that we're in at the moment. So it's not that, I think it's quite reassuring to know that we do have answers to the graphs. It's not that we kind of don't understand why something shot up or down. I think that's fair to say.
Mike, it doesn't half feel like we're sort of hurtling towards, for all of the, you know, TEF medals and, you know, other ways of judging quality, just feel like we're hurtling towards a sort of, you know, high and slightly lower than high tariff, mobile, go and live away from home, 3-year experience, you know, version of higher education, and then a kind of very hyper local commuter, you know, less subject choice. It feels like we're bifurcating towards a more European system without really any planning around it, doesn't it?
Or, you know, if you think about those people who secretly cheer the prospect of returning to polytechnics, you know, a roll back 30, 40 years where, you know, the local institution didn't have student accommodation and the mobile middle classes went to the choice of leafy lawn clad place that they wanted to go to. I don't think so. I think the, you know, the students will go to different places and find them. And there are certainly some of the issues with London are complex because there's a good group of students who are able to be perfectly mobile, and they are going to the highly selective institutions, particularly that one that has grown so much, but they're staying put. They're not moving into student accommodation to do it. And then there are other people who are being able to move around in different ways. I think that's not necessarily just going to be there. I think one of the questions will be is, are there some subject areas that are going to become quite complex to see the amount of diversity? If you play with one of the tables, you can find that there's one school of the University of London that has no one from quintile one in it. I mean, it's probably a rounding error, but, you know, that's a school that particularly favours one academic subject that is seen as a kind of elite thing. So we're gonna see a bit of that, but I think that people are going to move around. But clearly, if you've got a strategy which is to try and recruit more mobile middle class kids, you're going to be out there trying your hardest to go and get them to do kind of exciting, shiny subjects.
Jen, I guess, you know, part of the other thing that always strikes me when I look at data like this is, even where we can see, you know, kind of tariff bans, or even when we can see individual institutions, what I often yearn for is a sort of map. You know, what does this tell us about which bits of the country are likely to see, I don't know, pressure on their housing stock because there are more students kind of moving in? And then which bits of the country are going to be the kind of next South End where a campus has to close? You know, there are big geographical implications of these figures, aren't there?
Yeah, and I feel like that would be a really interesting piece of work, actually, because there's almost a gap between this data set, which is, you know, very much for providers. I mean, we're having a, you know, an interesting discussion about the sector level side of that, but it's limited in terms of what you can say because it's quite mixed. And then there's a gap between that and then the kind of very detailed work which will be going on now in institutions to spot the trends. Again, like you say, with regions and things like that, that's actually really valuable, you know, that gap, that piece of work. And I wonder if anyone's actually doing it. it's a real opportunity for somebody. But something about that which ties into the local skills agenda, it ties into the housing accommodation, it ties into the student support side of things. There's quite a lot to be gleaned from that, and I would be very interested to hear more about it.
Here's a question for you, Richard, right? If when a high tariff butterfly flaps its wings and admits some more students, that means that a subject area ends up having to close in a low tariff institution, is that trade-off worth it?
Well, I definitely think, and I teased this out in a HEPI report that I published a few years ago on the dynamics of the market on place. And if you want to have a market-based system, I think clearly you need to have a stronger government role in mitigating some of the negative results of that market-based system. And if there are subjects which you think are strategically valuable and important for the country in different parts of the world, then you would have a role to play in making sure that they are available in each region of the country. And I think that is particularly true at the moment around languages and whether you think that that is of real value to the nation going forward. And I would have thought that it would be a particularly important subject. And there'll be others too. Whereas as we've seen in the UCAS data, interestingly, and I'm not sure why others will have a better idea than me around the decline. You know, there's been a bit of a blip this year in terms of business studies, but growth in law, and you think they're the sort of two obvious subject areas which have been growing quite substantially over the last few years.
It's all these dodgy businesses that have been set up.
Well, there we go. So, but you wouldn't think that the government would need to intervene to sort of ensure that there are business courses in certain places if one falls off a cliff, for example.
Now, there's a human here, or maybe not. See if you can guess. Telling us about an event coming up in the new year. Hi, it's Jim from the team here. AI hasn't just changed how students write essays. It's forced us to confront what learning actually means. As The Secret Life of Students returns for its eighth year, we're launching major new research revealing how students are really using AI, discussing what Graduate Ready means in 2026, and showcasing institutions already reimagining assessment for authentic learning at scale. Taking a step beyond what has felt like, for many, a moment of crisis, we're looking at it as a chance for creativity and a chance to reimagine what higher education is actually for, to strip away assessments that measure memorization rather than meaning making, and to design learning experiences that develop capabilities no algorithm can replicate. At the event, you'll explore how AI can enhance rather than replace human learning, what that means for everyone, with a new government white paper reshaping the landscape from oracy initiatives to work-based learning at scale. The Secret Life of Students is the event you need. With institutions under pressure to demonstrate genuine learning gain, the timing couldn't be sharper. This is the essential gathering for anyone working on student experience, teaching practice, or education policy, where you'll get evidence, not platitudes, practical strategies, not theoretical debates, and a vision of higher education that's more human, not less. That's The Secret Life of Students, learning to be human in an age of AI, March 2026. Tickets are available now. Book on wonky.com/events.
Hi, I'm Wonky's news editor, Michael Salmon, with a couple of pieces of interesting higher education policy news from around the UK this week. So first of all, the Welsh Government put out a call for evidence on the future of its tertiary system. And there's a big accompanying publication which is quite candid about some of the issues that the nation is facing. So case in point, it's quite the thing for a government document to refer to how aggressive expansion by some higher tariff universities elsewhere in the UK is damaging the rest of the sector and is causing financial challenges to Wales's institutions. And it's sort of asking, you know, is big change needed there? But if you read just one part, make it the section on student finance, because there we hear publicly for the first time how the Welsh Government is still discussing with Westminster what this surprise budget change to Plan 2 student loan repayments that Rachel Reeves announced back in November. You know, what does that mean for graduates in Wales who are still on Plan 2, which maybe the Chancellor just forgot? You know, coming into an election where it's assumed there will be a change in government in Cardiff, the paper is very clear that Wales will almost certainly need to make changes both to student support and to graduate repayments in order to stay within the rules which are set by the Westminster Treasury. Elsewhere this week, this time in Scotland, the Scottish Government's Tertiary Education and Training Bill passed its final parliamentary stage. It's now just waiting for royal assent. It's essentially on the statute books. And there were some pretty important final changes, you know, some might say compromises that were needed to get the legislation through. For example, there's going to be a further expansion of fair work requirements in universities and colleges. There'll be new duties on universities about preventing gender-based violence. We even got the very interesting announcement that the Scottish Government is going to prepare a national funding strategy for the entire tertiary space, although inevitably this will be after the elections. And universities already seem a bit nervous about that. On Wonky, I've gone through where the legislation ended up, so do take a look.
Now, finally this week, the National Union of Students has launched a new campaign on student maintenance. And this time, we're meeting the parents, Richard.
Yeah, so NUS have launched what I personally think is a really good and positive and welcome campaign on student maintenance with a focus on how much it's costing parents. So some statistics from the report that NUS published this week. So most parents are paying over 200 quid a month to support their child at university, and almost 1 in 10 parents are paying over a grand a month, and 86% of parents contribute financially in some way regardless of their own income, which I think is a really interesting statistic. Now, a key focus of the campaign is on parental income thresholds, which I think most listeners of the podcast will know that have been frozen since 2008 and, of course, determine the amount of loan a student receives. And among several recommendations, the NUS are calling for the government to increase the parental income thresholds in line with inflation annually and in a one-off move to readjust them to reflect the years the thresholds have been frozen. A very ambitious recommendation given the economic circumstances of the country. But nevertheless, I think a really positive and welcome campaign to focus on the broader cost of this to the society.
Jen, there was this moment this week when they put out some revised choring guidance, because choring will carry on while we wait for Erasmus to come back. And they're obviously having a bit of difficulty spending some of the money on disadvantage. And so they've shifted the parental income threshold that counts, that defines what a disadvantaged student is for the Turing, you know, scheme to £35,000. Meanwhile, in the core financial maintenance loan system that gets you into university in the first place, we're still stuck at £25,000. This is lunacy, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, you know, the threshold being stuck at 25k is absolutely ridiculous. And it leads into all of these other discussions that we've been having about the pressure that parents are under, the pressure that students are under. You know, we had a discussion not that long ago on another podcast about working, students working. Part-time work is less available than it used to be, although in much greater need. And, you know, the impact that it has on student experience and outcomes and all of that is difficult. But, you know, the idea of parents basically as a necessity funding their child to go through university just isn't at absolute odds to the idea of access and widening participation, because, you know, most parents, whether they're well off or not, are kind of feeling the effects of the rising cost of living. And, you know, the effect of that only increases the more disadvantaged you are. So it's almost, you know, completely at odds in what it's actually trying to do in the first place. The whole thing is almost counterproductive.
Mike, well, I think it's probably fair to say that on kind of policy matters, NUS has been actually fairly quiet in recent years. But I mean, this is quite a key piece of work, isn't it? Because, you know, we know in other contexts that parents are much more involved than perhaps they used to be in all sorts of aspects of, you know, their child's higher education. And picking up on the struggles that parents will be having is probably a smart move, isn't it?
I you know, after 30 years, NUS has aimed a campaign at me again. I feel loved as a parent of university students. If you take the logic that two-thirds of the cohort are going to have some kind of education after the age of 18, and you take the logic that that's going to involve them spending a proportion of their time in education and not in work, and therefore, you know, are going to need to have some kind of family support. We've just got to have a look at that system, haven't we? It's just not going to be sensible to keep the threshold at, increasingly it will fall behind the minimum wage. We can see those kind of points where, you know, a single parent is now going to have to be making a contribution to their child away at the university. This is now lost where we thought we were going to go. The maintenance grants, obviously, we could really usefully do with some information on that. But the other thing I was reminded of this morning is we've only got one more year of this student finance system to come, because the LLE is coming the year after. Surely that's the opportunity to have a think about how this works. Because if we're going to chuck parental contribution into an LLE system, this is all going to be very strange. So I think there's a good chance for the government to get something together, but it's going to have to do it quickly, because I think it's DK reminds us this morning, LLE is here in a year's time. We need to have some kind of solution to make this work.
Now, Richard, the other thing that's been going on this week is, partly via the broadsheets and then the political press, there seems to be a kind of head of steam around lots of complaining about the kind of wider mis-selling of the student finance system, loan system. I've been listening to a podcast last night from the New Statesman, and it's been on all sorts of comment pieces. And the IFS this week put some stuff out too. Are we now moving into a period where the sort of reckoning around some of the strangeness of the student loan system actually captures some political attention?
So I've seen that, I haven't listened to the podcast yet from the New Statesman, but I've sort of seen some of the commentary from, I think it's Ollie Dugmore, isn't it, and others that have done this. And they've got some pushback from some experts in the sector about their sort of, you know, about some of the details in the system, which is obviously right and fair enough. But what really matters is how people feel. And increasingly, I think the sector, there's obviously changes, I think, that we could make to the system to make it better. But it's also a reflection, Jim, of the sort of intergenerational unfairness across a broader public policy. It's the fact that we're not building houses. It's the fact that the economy hasn't grown in an effective way for many years. And it's sort of creating a crunch together where there's a whole generation of people feeling that this is particularly unfair for them. And I think, you know, and it's interesting then what will manifest itself in terms of politics and policy and so on. The one other thing I just want to go back with what Jen and Mike and you have said, I think we do need to reflect at how extraordinary it is that the threshold hasn't changed since 2008. People born in the first half of 2008 are going to be doing their A-levels or equivalent this summer, and it hasn't changed since then. And do you guys know what the biggest selling single in 2008 was? Can anyone hazard a guess? Well, it was in the era where Simon Cowell ruined the Christmas number one. So it was Hallelujah by Alexandra Burke, I found out yesterday. But the important point is obviously something else happened in 2008, much more profound, which was the death of Lehman Brothers and everything else affecting the credit crunch. And it is an illustration of, you know, that event essentially probably the biggest event in our lifetimes in terms of the impact it has in terms of UK and global politics and what it has meant for the whole range of things, including the financing, of course, of higher education. And it really is important around, you know, the whole point that this government has said it is prioritising, but we haven't really seen it in policy, is it is so important for economic growth for this country to alleviate a whole range of different strange and challenges that we're facing in the public realm. But it's also, I think, what this campaign has really touched on, which is really important, is we cannot win on maintenance by just focusing on the student, unfortunately. And so by broadening it out to parents, and hopefully in future also thinking about the impact it has on grandparents and what is happening, we might be able to bring a broaden a coalition of support to make a difference to the student financing system, including this.
But I mean, that point about grandparents is really interesting, isn't it, Jen? Because the other thing that is on my mind a lot is that we are now entering a decade where, and I don't want them to, but a lot of those grandparents are going to die, and they're going to pass on a huge amount of baby boomer wealth. But of course, that wealth is not equally owned. owned. And we are in danger, aren't we, of moving to a system where a lot of students will be very well financed through their higher education, probably through inheritance. And then there will be this whole other set of students who very much are not.
Yeah, again, you know, it's a result that deepens the gap between the rich and the poor. And, you know, I mean, well, I was just going to say, actually, given the rules around inheritance tax, I'm not sure whether it is actually going to work out for some. But, you know, maybe the government could take some of that tax and put it back into higher education. I mean, yeah, that's definitely something to think about. I think what strikes me as part of this is that there seems to be a blank where kind of forward thinking is concerned. You know, what does the government think is going to happen if students either can't access higher education because they can't afford it, or do access it, realise they're, you know, screwed over financially, and then have to borrow or make crazy decisions in future because they're kind of clawing back what they've borrowed? And there doesn't seem to be a good outcome as a result of any of this. You know, I mean, it's limited that the government, even the government kind of hanging on to this decision and being kind of worried about the risk on the other side of it, it's just not a strategic move by the government, I don't think. I mean, I don't know what, I know it's easy to say all these things and what are the answers, you know, where did the money come from? But I just feel like this one is absolutely crazy. And the idea that the Turing thing has been increased to 35K, you know, they've always questioned. They've said themselves, we know that this isn't right. So how can they?
Don't get me started on chevening scholars. One other thing, Mike, you know, the reality is this is a complex system. You can press one button and it affects another lever, right? There are thresholds. There's how much people can borrow. There's how much people get. There's when they have to start repaying it. All these different levers affect all the others. But ultimately, underneath it, there was originally a cost-sharing assumption. You know, some of the early assumptions in the 9K fee system was the government wanted, you know, 55p in the pound back. And actually, the other thing that's really going on here is the Treasury looks like it wants a lot more back than it used to.
Yeah, so I mean, if you dig out the Vince Cable speeches about how this is a progressive system, you know, they need to be dusted off and tested back again. Because if there was a public policy understanding that's what we were going to do, that's certainly not where some of the tweaks have left us. There's a glitch with the Plan 2. Plan 5 is particularly problematic. People still chase after the interest rate as if that's the key thing. So I think the kind of wholesale reselling of what a graduate contribution looks like, I mean, we haven't been banging on about graduate tax for a while, but that kind of what is this financing doing and how does it operate? And are we sure that the policy goal, i.e. that it's broadly progressive, that it enables people to benefit from higher education, whatever their background, are we actually achieving that? Or have we actually baked in some problems that we really need a lever to have a think about this? And I do think that wider look would be really helpful just to make sure, are we achieving the objectives we set out? Or do we need to have a bit more of a sense of, it's not just pulling up one thing and seeing what happens with that. We need to look at the thing in the place. And as I say, the LLE might be an excuse to make sure that that works for everyone.
I'm really struck, Richard, just finally, on your point about feelings. You know, one of the things that lots of people have said in that kind of broadsheet political press stuff this week is, you know, effectively, no one told them that they would be paying for 30 years. You know, and I think what they mean is they expected that because it was sold as a loan, that one day they would pay off the loan, and they're upset that they're not going to be able to pay off the loan. But of course, 2/3 of students not paying off in full was a design feature, not a bug.
Yeah, and I don't recognise the 45% figure. That, you know, Jim, I'm sure you got it from somewhere. I always recall David Willetts talking about the 30% RAB charge being the sort of a bit that the government's going to subsidise for this bit. And that's because it had obviously increased, right? And it was salient for him to do so, I presume. Take a slightly different view to you and others, was that the Theresa May decision after the 2017 election to increase the sort of threshold before you start repaying was an absolute disaster. And the reason why I thought that was because you then got into this whole connotation of it being not value for money for the taxpayer and the state as a result of this. And I thought actually we did need to rebalance it. And there was a sort of a progressive paradox where the more progressive it became, the less sustainable, and therefore government would impose restrictions on who can actually go to university. But we seem to have gone completely in the opposite direction, and we haven't, in my view, found the right balance for that. And as you and Mike have alluded to, the system is becoming increasingly complex. And so I think we probably do need to look at a new lever moving forward.
So that's about it for this week. Remember to go in deep on anything we've discussed today. You'll find links in the show notes on wonky.com. Don't forget to subscribe. Just search for The Wonky Show wherever you get your podcasts. And if you want to get ahead of everything going on in UKHE, just click subscriptions on the site to find out more. So thanks very much to Mike, Richard, Jen, Michael, Salmon for making it all happen behind the scenes. We'll be back next week. Mark will be here. Until then, stay wonky.